Senator Sheldon Whitehouse has fought to reduce carbon pollution, protect our air and water, and position America as a leader in the clean energy economy. As a member of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, co-founder of the Senate Climate Action Task Force, and co-founder of the Senate Oceans Caucus, he plays a key role in illuminating the challenge in crafting policies addressing climate change and environmental protection. Thank you. Jonathan Stone, to my right, joined Save the Bay in early 2009 as the organization's fourth executive director. During his tenure, Save the Bay has successfully challenged ill-conceived and damaging infrastructure projects, sounded the alarm on changing climate conditions, completed dozens of habitat restoration projects, achieved major legislative victories, expanded Save the Bay's environmental education programs, and strengthened its financial foundation. And Avery Brookins, moderating our discussion today, started at Rhode Island Public Radio as environmental reporter in April 2017. Before joining the station, she was a general assignment reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio, and prior to that reported on health, science, and the community for Philadelphia's public radio station, WHYY. And Joan Hall. Joan works in mixed media and large-scale installations with an emphasis on the materials of paper, glass, and metal. Hall received her BFA at the Columbus College of Art and Design in Ohio and her MFA at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. She studied printmaking, papermaking, with Garner Tullis at the Institute of Experimental Printmaking in San Francisco. And Joan is known for her innovative approaches to material and processes. Her work has been exhibited nationally and internationally, and she has been the recipient of numerous grants and awards. Her work has been published in national and international books, as in numerous public and private collections. Hall is the Emerita Kenneth E. Hudson of Art in the Fox School of Art and Design at Washington University in St. Louis, and currently a visiting critic in the graduate printmaking program at the Rhode Island School of Design. Thank you again, Joan. Thank you all.
And so this discussion today is actually turning out to be very timely with the news yesterday, with the Environmental Protection Agency's administrator, Scott Pruitt, resigning. So before we get into that, I just kind of wanted to start with a more lighter kind of question for each of our panelists here. I was curious to know how each of you got into environmental advocacy. So Senator Whitehouse, maybe you want to start?
Slowly and steadily would probably be the description. I grew up a child of a Foreign Service family, and we were almost always posted in poor coastal countries, and the experience of those seashores, I think, really stuck with me. I then made the most amazing decision of my life and convinced a marine biologist to marry me and learned an enormous amount from Sandra. And then, you know, worked on issues in politics for a while, but when I got to Washington, I got doubly motivated because, A, we need to get a lot done, but, B, there was an awful lot of cheating and lying and bullying taking place to try to protect the polluting. And so my sense of kind of the underdog got lit up by that, and it, to this day, you know, whets me off that we're in the situation that we're in because of that lying and bullying and all the mischief of the industry. So that is just like an extra emphasis on the fights, because it's a justice fight as well as an environmental fight at this point.
Joan, how about you?
I sort of came about it also slowly. I got one closer. Sorry, I hate these things. I grew up in Ohio. I'm a recent resident of Rhode Island, but I was sailing at 16, and I love the water. And my work started out doing things about the water, but then as I got older, at one point I got seriously ill. And I started thinking about how as we age, we have their illnesses that many of our generation, especially mine, are getting more so than the generation previous to us. And I started looking at articles about the ocean and how the ocean was getting polluted. And then I started looking at other things about how the they're finding cures for cancer from coral reefs in the ocean. So I started deciding that my work would move away from just being about the beauty of the ocean, even though I feel that beauty is an important message, which I use in my work. But I wanted it to have more of a message about what's going on in our world.
And just out of curiosity, which illnesses are you referring to?
Well, there's some cures for cancer. There's some blue-green algae that's they found can be some like cures for cancer. There's some things, some sponges that they're saying. I have notes. I'm trying to remember exactly what it was for Alzheimer's. And I was reading recently that actually a marine ecologist wrote that we're probably 300 to 400 times more likely to find medical cures in the ocean than we are on land. So protecting our ocean, I think, will also protect our world.
And Jonathan, how did you get involved with environmental advocacy?
So my excuse is that my dad made me do it. And I'm kind of joking, but kind of not. I grew up spending summers in the bay to the east, Buzzards Bay, and grew up outside of Boston. And when it was summertime, I would be on the water, in the water, under the water, every which way you could. Every day I was down in Marion. But when I say my dad made me do it, I actually am somewhat serious in that when I was 10 years old, he said, "We're going into Boston today." And I said, "What are we doing? I don't want to go into Boston." He said, "Yeah, we're going into Boston. We're going to a little place called Central Wharf." And we drove into Central Wharf, and lo and behold, I'm attending the groundbreaking of the New England Aquarium with Senator Ed Brooke and Governor Frank Sargent and my father. My father founded the New England Aquarium. And I have to tell you, people looked at him like he was out of his mind. If some of you may remember, Boston Harbor, I know Sheldon, you do, Boston Harbor in the 1960s was an open cesspool. So that was sort of one thing. The second thing was I went to prep school, and when I landed at university, I landed at a little place called Providence on the crew team. And within 2 days of landing in Providence, I signed up to show up at Marston Boathouse on the Seekonk River, and I thought, this is going to be great. I'm going to get out on a shell in the pristine upper bay waters of Narragansett Bay, and I get in the shell, and off we go, and I look at the end of my oar, and there are literally dead fish. There is sewage, raw sewage. There is, in those days, not much plastic, although that's a problem today, which we'll get to, and one of the most polluted waterways in the country. And here we are these many years later, and oh my, what progress we've made. So that's my story.
Perfectly going into my next question, are things better or worse environmentally than when you started your activism?
Well, listen, you know, so many people in Rhode Island from all walks of life have made Rhode Island a phenomenal national success story in cleaning up one of the most polluted estuaries in the United States. And Senator Whitehouse is one of those people. So many elected officials, volunteer organizations, and grassroots voters made it happen in Rhode Island. Save the Bay was certainly a champion of the cleanup of the bay. And there are people in this room and people in Jamestown and Newport and Middletown and Portsmouth and all over the state of Rhode Island who really made it happen by shining a light on pollution and drawing attention to problems and speaking out and demanding action. And so that's we've come a long way. So we have certainly problems that we have to deal with. We'll talk about a few of those tonight. But we all should be proud of the incredible progress. People come to Rhode Island to celebrate an environmental success story. That doesn't happen very often.
And Joan, what about from your perspective? Have things gotten better or worse?
I'd say yes and no. One is I grew up in Ohio when the Cuyahoga River caught on fire, and they have cleaned up Lake Erie because the Great Lakes are a beautiful body of water. But then, on the other hand, the piece on the back wall, which is called The Invasion of Hall Cove, in 2015 I was doing a beach cleanup, and I walked out on Hall Cove, and there it was probably a foot deep of this sort of pink-like algae. And I thought, this is Rhode Island. The beach should not be pink. And so I took a photo, and then a friend of mine, one of her friends was worked at Woods Hole, and we sent her the photograph, and I said, what is this? And she said, it's invasive algae that because the waters are warming, it's coming from Asia, and it's not dying. So invasive, so that's the no part. So, you know, but yes, places are getting cleaner. You know, I've spent a lot of time sailing in Florida also, and I've seen bays that I wouldn't have put my foot in the 80s are clean now.
And Senator, what about you?
I would say we're doing better, a lot better at the old pollutants, and we're losing on the new pollutants.
What are
specifically plastics and carbon emissions? Those are probably the two most consequential ones that are out there, and we've been forestalled from doing anything meaningful on carbon emissions for about 30 years now. By the way, the first hearing on climate change in the United States Senate was held just over 30 years ago in the Environment and Public Works Committee by its then chairman, Republican Senator John Chafee of Rhode Island. So here we are 30 years later, still having that same fight against an industry that has immensely ramped up its capacity to deny and dissuade. And so that's a predicament of political will. The plastics is a predicament of realization. And we've really only in the last 2 years had the big realization about what this means and what it actually might mean if it could be, you know, we don't know necessarily how these outcomes turn out, but it could be a lot worse than we think right now. So those are the two big ones to me right now.
And I'm curious to know what your thoughts are about Scott Pruitt's resignation.
Good riddance.
Yes.
The sad part in all of this is that the thing that caused his departure was a whole array, a whole persistent array of small, sleazy things that he did. And clearly, you add them up, and that is definitely, in my view, a firing offense. But all of that overlooks the big corruption, which is that he was there not to work for the public. He was there to work for the fossil fuel industry. This was the prototypical captured agency designed to do the bidding of the regulated industry. And that should be the real scandal. That should have been the cause for his firing. And the fact that it wasn't is something we should not overlook. A good Scott Pruitt, who is still the servant of the fossil fuel industry and still destroying progress, that ought to be a firing offense, too. It shouldn't take an unexplainable taste for used hotel mattresses to get you there.
And should we be more or less concerned about the future of the agency and the environment now that he's gone?
You know, Andrew Wheeler is an interesting guy. He's the acting, and he's probably going to be the acting for some time. He comes out of the Environment Public Works Committee. He worked for Jim Inhofe, the famous snowball-wielding climate denier. He is terrible substantively on all of these issues. On the other hand, we've worked with him for quite some time, and he is what I would call honest in his transactions. He doesn't lie to you about where he's going or what he can agree to or what he can't agree to or any of that. So he is an honest broker with a very bad policy point of view. And what I'm hoping is that as an honest broker, he will come to realize now that he's making these decisions that there are only two ways this ends for the fossil fuel industry. One is splat on the ground with a really bad crash that economists are starting to talk about as being a systemic economic hazard for us. And the other is a parachute landing that the industry can survive, but the only way you get to that parachute landing is if you have a price on carbon and a mechanism for avoiding the calamitous collapse. And if he has the brains to think that through, and I think he does, then there's a case to be made that he's actually serving the industry by finding the less calamitous path to its collapse. Because a catastrophic collapse is a very bad economic consequence for a lot of folks outside the industry as well.
Avery, can I just add to Senator Whitehouse's comments? In New England, New England is what's called Region 1 of the EPA. So the EPA is divided up into geographic regions. And we do have a new administrator, Region 1, who really comes with pretty high marks. And I met her about 2 weeks ago. I'm sure Senator Whitehouse knows her. Alex Dunn is her name. And the first thing she said to me is, the best thing about Scott Pruitt is that he doesn't know where New England is. And furthermore, he doesn't care where New England is. So I do think, I would just say, there are a lot of really good people at EPA and who are dedicated. They are there because they're environmentalists. And if you can just, if Region 1 can just stay out of the limelight and under the radar, as the term goes, we've got some support. Again, a lot emanates from Washington, and that's the grave worry right now. But there are some great people at EPA that are very supportive of what we're trying to do here.
I agree.
One other thing, Senator, I just read yesterday that they're thinking of opening up like something like 760 million acres of the ocean to commercial fishing. Do you have any thoughts on that, or know anything about what, if that's going to actually happen?
Yeah, first under Bush and then under President Obama, both presidents used their authority under what's called the Antiquities Act to declare monuments. In theory, that was so that Teddy Roosevelt could protect, the Grand Canyon. But for the first time, President Bush and then after him, President Obama used it to declare ocean monuments. And Obama both expanded the Bush one out off Hawaii in the Pacific and created the first one in the Atlantic off of our shores out where the deep happens and there are canyons up along the shelf, and they protected the canyon area. And so the idea is that they're going to try to undo that. What's an unanswered question is how that law works, whether it's a one-way ratchet, and once a president has declared something to be a monument, it can't be undeclared by a future president. Trump has treated it as he can undeclare it, and he started undeclaring, particularly out in Utah at Bears Ears and at the Escalante and places like that. But it's not at all clear that he has the authority to do that, and if you read the statute, it doesn't appear that he has the authority to do that. So there are three or four pieces of litigation, including one in Boston, in which that question will be settled. And I suspect it'll be settled in favor of these monuments, and that you can't go back and undo what a president has done without going through Congress. If Congress were to do it, that would be one thing. But so that's where we are on that. I think that attempt will fail as a matter of law. I hope it will fail as a matter of law.
And so shifting gears a little bit, according to the group Conservation International, only a third of recyclable materials are recycled in the U.S. And Senator Whitehouse, I was wondering if you knew why that is.
Landfills. It's very easy to just put it in a different bin, and it, by and large, ends up disposed of without going into the ocean if it's gone to a proper landfill and it's run properly and so forth. This is what distinguishes us from Asia, and this is why the trade piece of dealing with all this ocean plastic is so important, because there are six Asian countries that put the vast majority of the plastic in the oceans into the oceans. And they don't do it off of boats, and they don't do it off the coast. They do it by having terrible upland waste disposal. They don't have garbage trucks. They don't have trash cans. They don't have dumps. So it all ends up in the river, and from the river it ends up in the sea. And because the stuff lasts forever, even if its journey started 15 years ago, there it is. But the stories of the Volvo racers going through the mucky parts of the Pacific is pretty horrifying.
Is there anything being done at the federal level to deal with plastic pollution in the ocean?
We got my bill passed.
Which bill is that?
We got my bill passed. Save Our Seas Act, the first piece of marine plastic debris legislation Congress has ever passed. It passed the Senate unanimously, and it passed the relevant House committee with strong bipartisan vote. I think they actually voice voted it. So we're just waiting for it to be put on some vehicle in the House to pass and become law, and then we have the first piece of marine debris legislation in the country's history. And one kind of touching story is Jim Inhofe, Snowball Man, who I mentioned is kind of my nemesis on all things climate and who I have just raging wars with. And he's actually an original co-sponsor of this piece of legislation. As a boy, he'd go from Oklahoma down to the Texas coast and stand out at night on the beaches with a flashlight to wave away trucks and jeeps driving up and down the beach so they wouldn't crush the little baby sea turtles coming out of their shells and going down to the water. So as awful as he has been on all things climate, he has a soft spot in his heart for sea turtles. He became an original co-sponsor because he's so awful on everything else. He's like a flashing beacon to all Republicans saying, safe bill, safe to land. You may co-sponsor this without getting in trouble. And that's really why it passed unanimously. So he's my frenemy.
And I want to bring it down to the local level. And so, Jonathan, how close or far away is Save the Bay from achieving its goal of a swimmable and fishable bay?
Well, it's a great question. The answer is that we're in a marathon. We have achieved great success throughout much of the bay. But what once was widespread pollution from wastewater treatment, industrial waste, polluted runoff, is now more localized in nature. So while we've cleaned up sort of the big, ugly pipes that discharge pollutants, whether it's bacteria or industrial waste, into the bay, we now have a more localized set of problems. Quidnick Island has significant water pollution problems on the west side, on First Beach, Second Beach, Third Beach, and those sources of pollution, I like to say, are, in the old days, you could point the finger at Providence and say, that's Providence's fault. Well, that isn't the case anymore. The problems around Narragansett Bay today are largely driven by local sources of pollution. Greenwich Bay, for example, is one of the most polluted embayments within the context of the bay, and that's mostly due to human waste, improperly treated wastewater, and polluted runoff from the neighborhood, again, not circulating down from Providence or the densely populated northern part of the state. So the answer to the question is we have many sections of the bay that are perennially challenged with water quality problems, particularly closed embayments around the bay, 100 Acre Cove, for example, the Seekonk River, Mount Hope Bay, Tawisset. These are areas where we have significant water quality problems. And unfortunately, it's a little bit like you probably heard the adage about software developers will talk about almost being done, you know, finishing that software product. It takes 90% of the time to do the last 5% of the project. And that's a bit of the struggle we have now. Water pollution problems today are much more complex and much more challenging because they involve all of us. We're all part of the problem in a sort of general sense. It's polluted runoff from the landscape of the watershed, 1,600 square miles, half of which is in Massachusetts, so you have a jurisdictional challenge. So we made great progress. We have a lot of work to do, and I just want to add, because I know Sheldon is very much at the forefront of this, climate change makes all of those challenges worse. So to the extent that we feel like we're making progress, we are fighting a heavy tide going the wrong direction, and that is related to rising water temperatures and changing climate conditions. So it's no time to ease up on the throttle.
Do you have a time frame for how long you think it'll take for?
Oh yeah, it's going to be like 12 years and 3 months, and we'll be Sheldon, 14 days. No, But you know what I would say? What we like to say at Save the Bay, progress is what we're after. You know, don't let perfection be the enemy of progress. And if we can clean up one embayment one time, that's progress made. And so our focus is to really focus on a hyper-local level and address these sources of pollution and do it one bay at a time.
What more needs to be done for the bay to clean it up?
Well, a big, you know, public investment dollars are really crucial. Save the Bay and partners led an initiative at the General Assembly this year with strong support from the governor to introduce an environmental bond that we like to call a Bay Bond. Most of what's in this $47.3 million bond is to address water quality problems and climate change resilience problems. The first time ever an environmental bond in the state has included climate resilience initiatives to protect wastewater treatment plants, to protect public infrastructure, and to preserve the natural systems that are so important to the health and ecology of the Bay and actually protect communities. So this environmental bond just passed the General Assembly. If your voters in Rhode Island, please vote for, I don't know what number it'll be on the ballot, but vote in November and vote for the environmental bond, the Bay Bond.
And Joan, I'm curious to know what sorts of damage you've seen in local waters.
Well, one, I mentioned the invasive algae, but I'm just seeing plastic. I used to sail in the bay in the 80s, and you just didn't see plastic, and you see it everywhere now, no matter what, and you see, you know, tiny bits of it. I also noticed, like in Dutch Harbor, you used to be able to pick mussels off of the rocks, and they're no longer there. So, you know, they're little things, but those little things all add up to be big things.
And at what point did this issue inspire your artwork?
Well, I think it's what I mentioned, that when I got sick, I started thinking about that the ocean was getting sick and in a weird kind of way. And I started thinking about John F. Kennedy's statement that he gave the America's Cup crew that, you know, that we have the same amount of salt in our blood as is in the ocean. And no matter whether we come here to sail or to watch it, that we're coming back from whence we came. And so that just made me think that we really are, you know, we have to remember that, you know, the ocean is really a part of us, and it's really important. And that's how I started. You know, as an artist, I use scientific facts and information about climate change. I've kept scrapbooks since about 2003 of articles I've read in the New York Times or the Washington Post or online. And then out of that comes my interest in sort of creating artworks, and sometimes it's some of sort of my fantasy world about how I think about things.
And how do you measure the impact that your work has on people, or is there a way to do that?
I don't think I measure it. That's something I think for politicians to do. But I think this is one. It's like there's a conversation about it, or I've had people walk up to me and they see it as these beautiful objects first, and then they read the titles, or they talk to me, or they start really seeing that there's more to it, and it just initiates that conversation, and that's what is important for me.
And then going back to Jonathan, could you tell us about Save the Bay's community cleanups and the international coastal cleanup? I'm wondering how much and what kind of trash was collected locally last year.
A lot. So just for the audience, there's an ocean conservation group in D.C. called the Ocean Conservancy that Sandra has been very involved with for many, many years. And the Ocean Conservancy coordinates on one weekend around the globe a cleanup day or cleanup weekend. And that's called the International Coastal Cleanup. In Rhode Island, Save the Bay is the local coordinator of cleanups. Last year in September 21st or something, I forget the exact date, Save the Bay organized 90 different cleanups on 65 beaches. We cleaned up 8 tons of trash. Most of it is plastic. The number one offending item are food containers. The number two is bottles, beverages, mostly beverage containers. The number one most prolific item are cigarette butts. Back in the day when I wasn't supposed to smoke, and I don't now, but cigarette butts were made of cotton. Now they're made of plastic, and they don't biodegrade. So in terms of numbers of items, the number one most prolific thing we find is cigarette butts. Just more broadly, Save the Bay runs about, last year, 153 cleanups around the state over the course of the summer months. We collected 29,000 pounds of trash. None of it is from the Pacific coast. It's all local. So we have a local problem as much as we have in addition to having a global problem. And we had 4,069 people engage with us on both our beach cleanups, our salt marsh plantings, our storm drain marking programs, and so forth. So we're busy.
And is the 29,000 pounds of trash, is that amount surprising for a state of our size?
So any amount of trash is surprising in a state that cares so much about the ocean and the coast. What I think is most surprising, though, is that we do it every year. And we go back to the same beaches every year. And we pick up trash every year. And that, to me, is the really discouraging part. I'd rather not be doing beach cleanups ever. We want to prevent pollution. And the plastics issue is even more disturbing because we can't clean up plastic anymore when the bits are so small. They're part of the rack line. They're becoming part of the environment. They're being ingested by marine organisms. So we have a fundamental pollutant, which in the trade we call an emerging contaminant. What it is little bits of plastic that are getting into the food web. Beach cleanups are not going to solve that problem. So we have got to go after the issue of prevention. We have to prevent it from entering our waterways in the first place.
Oh, I just want to make a comment about the microplastic. I did a trip with five gyres from Florida to the Eleuther Islands, and we had a trawler. In fact, late Michael Brown had a lot to do in Jamestown to funding that. And every place where we pulled up bits, I mean, all the way across, we picked up plastic, and like we were picking it out of the grasses with tweezers. That's how tiny they are. And when we got to the Eleuther Islands, the school there, the students had been catching fish, and they were opening the stomachs of all the fish, and they found plastic in all the fish. And, you know, scientists don't know if that's going to affect us. You know, they're working on it to figure it out, but they don't know. It's a question.
And Jonathan, what coastal areas are of particular concern right now, and why?
From a plastics point of view, do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, plastics, they're everywhere. I mean, we're doing a research project in Mount Hope Bay, which is just off of Fall River. We're trawling for microplastics, and we're finding high concentrations of microplastics in the middle of Mount Hope Bay. Yes, of course, if you go to a cove, you're going to find stuff that floats that'll accumulate in a cove. We're doing a project this summer with a fisherman who is based here in Newport. One of the most persistent problems the fishing fleet will find is that the trawlers, the scallopers, will bring in tens of pounds of plastic in their nets from trawling the bottom. So offshore Rhode Island, there may not be anything in the surface. You'll find vast quantities of plastic sitting on the bottom of the ocean in Rhode Island Sound right now. And we're trying, this project is to characterize that problem to understand the extent of it and how we might address how to prevent it. But it's really ubiquitous. That's what makes it so discouraging.
Yeah.
And if you're looking at the climate problem, you have to look in unusual places. A lot of our shore is rocky and quite high and therefore not immediately vulnerable. The two most vulnerable communities in Rhode Island are Warwick and Barrington because they're up the bay a ways, and when you go up 2, 3, 4, 6, whatever feet, you end up going back a lot farther than you do here in Newport. But they're low-lying areas all over the place. If the current predictions of the Coastal Resources Management Council of Rhode Island come true, then there'll be a new island of western Newport that is separate from the main part of Newport. Jamestown will be three islands, not one. Block Island will be two islands, not one. And Warwick Neck, up near the airport, is an island. Tiverton and Warren become islands. born in Bristol, become islands. Tiverton gains an island, I should say. And we end up having to completely redraw the map of Rhode Island, which has been fundamentally unchanged since before any of us arrived, when it was just native peoples, the old Narragansetts and Wampanoags for centuries. Their map was our map, pretty much. And in by the end of the century, that will have changed, and it will change to the great detriment of not only the people on the coast, but because it's so damaging to the economy as that goes south, it's going to be very hard for the Rhode Island economy. Freddie Mac, the big federal housing company, compares the coming crash in coastal real estate unfavorably to the recent mortgage meltdown that we had beginning in 2008 in terms of its effects cascading through the economy. That's not a thing I want to live through again.
And several Rhode Island cities and towns have banned the use of plastic bags in stores, and Newport actually being one of them, if I'm not mistaken. And so, Jonathan, I'm wondering if you think that this will have an impact on local ocean trash levels.
So I think every communities are choosing different approaches, and I think Newport, I know, passed a bag ban, which is, I think, terrific. I think communities have taken kind of different approaches, whether it's bags, you know, shopping bags or bottles. We at Save the Bay are working on legislation at a state level that we think will help align us, instead of having 39 different sets of regulations that reflect, that are designed to prevent use of single-use plastic bags. We're working on, with various partners, a statewide approach to eliminating single-use bags. So I think honestly, there is what's required is getting people involved in understanding and educating our elected officials that we have a persistent problem, and a bag ban or a bottle bill can really have an important, powerful effect on getting people's attention. But it's a pervasive problem, and as I said, from the data shows food containers, bottles, cigarette butts, and you know, other large debris are the biggest single kinds of items we find. So yes, straws and bags are important and helpful. And again, don't let perfection be the enemy of progress, but it's a pretty big problem we have to tackle through a variety of different means.
And I want to open this next question up for anyone who wants to take it on. Do you have hope that you can make environmental progress under the Trump administration?
That sounds actually like it's more for me than anybody else. Actually, I do. The marine plastics bill we did despite the Trump administration, just working in Congress. The Trump administration is very disengaged from Congress, and when they do come, they usually don't know what they're doing and aren't very helpful. So as long as you stay away from them, you can actually get a fair amount accomplished. I think for a lot of Republicans, their suppressed distaste for their president kind of emotionally causes them to want to do more things. I've never had a more productive time as a senator than I have since Trump got in, and I think it's partly because some of my Republican friends who, you know, can't bear the guy but can't say that, look for other ways to try to reassure their voters at home that they're still being productive and working with Democrats and so forth. So that's happening. And then there's some real power to the built-in expertise in the government. And I'll give you two quick examples. The guy who was just made the head of NOAA is a former climate-denying no-goodnik from Congress named Bridenstine. He got over to NOAA, and in his first hearing in the Senate, he was asked, so what's up with climate change? And he said, oh, climate change is, like, really important and serious. The science is very clear that it's driven by carbon emissions. We need to do something about it because it's, you know, changing the fundamental operating systems of our planet. And the senator who had asked him the question said, so would that be an evolution of your views? And he said, yeah, that's an evolution of my views. I think what happened is that he got over to NOAA and knew that he would have zero credibility as the NOAA administrator if he was doing something preposterous as denying climate change. You can get away with that in Congress because they're paid to, and threatened to make sure they do that. But when you're over at NOAA, it's a whole different environment. Your scientists won't respect you if you're saying idiotic things. So he flipped. The director of national intelligence is a former senator named Dan Coats. He had no interest in anything having to do with climate change. Every year we do a national intelligence threat assessment. The Trump national intelligence threat assessment came out about 5 months ago with Dan Coats' signature as the director of national intelligence on the front of it. And you can flip through to about page 18, and there's a chapter on the national security threat to the United States from climate change. Now, they had to know that that was going to go up to the White House and be highly unwelcome. But Dan had the principle and the character, and I think a little bit the Bridenstine problem. He knew that he couldn't have the respect of his team if he didn't do the right thing. And so even in the Trump administration, the full-on climate change report came out, and they had to. They couldn't stop it. They had to clear it. The DNI report came out. Bridenstine has reversed. There's a tide of reality that even all the mischief of the fossil fuel industry is unable to stop, even in this administration. And we got rid of Pruitt.
I also think that regardless of any administration, it still also starts at the local level. In Jamestown alone, I mean, just in this year, in 2018, there's the single-use plastic ban for shopping bags. And then the local East Ferry Deli that sells thousands of drinks, they switched to paper straws. So if you look at the bright side, if people start doing things, if everyone starts doing just one thing, like, you know, carry those shopping bags, don't even if they have single use, hand them yours, it helps.
Yeah, and I want to echo Joan's comment as well that, you know, our message since the Trump administration took office was that we own it here, locally. I mean, we have to take responsibility for our own leadership on environmental issues. And, you know, let's remember, the federal government delegates certain authorities to the state of Rhode Island to protect the environment. And we have a lot of power locally to enforce the Clean Water Act, to enforce the Clean Air Act. And it's incumbent upon us to make sure that our state elected leaders know that these are important to us. And, you know, I think the message is getting through because they understand that they're not going to get help from the administration. They're going to get help from Congress. I think Congress has really stepped up with the latest budget authorization. But, you know, we own it here, and it's our job as voters, as constituents, as activists, to speak up and let our governor know, let our state rep, our state senator know, let our town council know that these issues are important to us. Because we look at California. The U.S. administration said, we're pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, and the governor says, we're not. We're going to lead on climate issues. So the states, the power is devolving to the states on many of these environmental issues, and that's incumbent upon us to speak out.
Do environmental advocates need to change their approach for advocating for change at all in this political climate?
I mean, I think... you know, my biggest fear in life is complacency. And I think this is where we need to have awareness of the nature of the problems. And I think Joan said it really well. You know, we each have an impact in the environment in our daily lives. And it all starts with your own behavior. So, you know, do the little things in life. And if we all did little things in life, we'd make a big impact. So I think it starts with, you know, just being a good environmental citizen, environmental student, you know, a steward. You don't have to radically change your lifestyle, but there are things all of us can do. And then I think politically, be more active, support, you know, our elected representatives at the state and the federal level, and let them know. I mean, Sheldon knows. I visit Sheldon in Washington once a year. He's very gracious with his time, and he knows why I'm there, to remind him what we care about at Save the Bay. And Sheldon, it doesn't need any reminding about us. He's a member of Save the Bay, has been involved for a long time. But I just think the general principle is it's our job to make sure that our elected representatives know what's important to us.
The one piece of advice that I would have is that we have to learn a new level of skepticism, I would say, about what some of corporate America is saying and doing about, particularly about climate change. The biggest companies in America, Facebook, Apple, Google, Microsoft, and others are all part of an enormous trade group called TechNet that comes to Washington to lobby about the stuff that is of interest to them. And if you go to all of their websites and get their positions on climate, you'd think they were absolutely fabulous, and you'd think you could trust them to lobby on this issue. No. After 2 years of beating on them, they finally mentioned climate change for the first time this year in their lobbying materials. And it was a weak little mention. These are huge companies who could have a big effect in Congress if they bothered to try. But they have other issues they care about. They have tax issues. They have privacy issues. Facebook has all its troubles. So this just falls aside. Coke and Pepsi have terrific climate change websites. They're cleaning up their act inside their corporate fence lines. They're pushing sustainability out their supply chains. But when they come to Washington, you add up their lobbying presence, and it is net negative against their stated position on climate change. They do virtually nothing through the American Beverage Association except fund the United States Chamber of Commerce, which is our biggest and most inveterate enemy getting anything done on climate change. So we're going to have to learn, a little bit like we had to learn that when the Cuyahoga River, as Joan said, when the Cuyahoga River caught fire, you had to develop your consciousness a little bit more. You can't take the corporate representations at face value. You've got to drill through and see what they're pushing for in Congress to know how serious they are. And, of course, the worst of all are the oil companies. When you read in the newspaper that Exxon and Chevron and Shell acknowledge that climate change is real, know their product is causing it, and support a price on carbon? No, they don't. I see them all the time. I see the front groups that they operate through. They are still 100% enemies of the price on carbon they claim publicly to support. And that kind of trickery and that kind of gamesmanship is something that we as a public, as citizens, need to be a little bit more alert to. Having a public-facing statement that says one thing and having a lobbying presence that is directing exactly the opposite ought not to be acceptable, but we've got to kind of have a little bit of a step-up moment as citizens to realize that a lot of this stuff is very two-faced and they need to have a little bit more clarity about their positions. Should not be asking too much of a major corporation to have its lobbying position aligned with its publicly stated position. When that's asking too much, we have a problem.
Okay. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Joan Hall, Jonathan Stone, thank you guys so much.